Das ist Bern einfach. Jeden Tag die richtige Dosis Politik vom Nebelspalter. Kritisch und unabhängig.
Der Podcast wird gesponsert von Auditswiss, Ihrer Experte rund ums Thema Revision und Wirtschaftsprüfung. www.auditswiss.ch.
Wir sind heute Bern einfach live in Zürich mit dem Lord Frost und alles zu den Brexit-Verträgen, die wir wissen wollen. Heute dabei sind Markus Somm, Chefredaktor vom Nebelspalter, der Oliver Zimmer, Historiker, und der Lord Frost, der ein enger Vertrauter war von Boris Johnson und natürlich die Verträge und die Brexit-Verhandlungen sehr, sehr eng begleitet hat. Wir schalten jetzt rein in das Gespräch.
My Hochdeutsch is a bit better than my Schweizerdeutsch, so thank you for that. So, I mean, my frustration with the EU really goes back to that first time in Brussels in the 90s when I was in my 20s and working as a British diplomat in the machine. And really, I went with the kind of conventional opinions of most British diplomats about the EU, which is they think is a jolly good thing. And I changed my mind really quite quickly about it because it seemed to me to be an organisation, even in the mid-90s, that was hostile to the nation state and constantly seeking ways to suck power out of the nation state and the national democracies without much legitimacy in doing so. And second, that it was a fundamentally socialist or social democrat organization. It wasn't interested in free markets. It was interested in regulating and controlling and eliminating competition across the European territory. So I quite quickly came to those sort of views. I mean, obviously, I was in the Foreign Office for another 25 years after that. And I think it's easy to forget, and a lot of Brits do forget, that until quite recently, most British governments were quite Eurosceptic. Even the Tony Blair government was quite Eurosceptic. Gordon Brown, his successor as Prime Minister, spent a lot of time fighting to keep us out of the Euro. It was possible for somebody who was sceptical about Europe still to kind of work in the machine. Up till quite recently, it was really only, I guess, 15 years ago, 2010 or so, when it became clear you just couldn't reconcile. You know, if you didn't believe in European integration, at least to some extent, it was going to be difficult. And mm-hmm. that's why mm-hmm. I ended up leaving.
Yes. Thank you for that. I mean, the second question is perhaps even more pertinent because it's written extensively about that. The question is, how do you think post-Brexit Britain is doing? Because when you read the newspapers here and in Britain, I think the verdict is mainly negative.
Yeah, we're doing all right, yeah. I think. it's been a difficult couple of decades in Britain, to be honest, as it has across much of Europe. And Britain has certainly not properly recovered from the financial crash in 2008. Our productivity and growth record took a dip then and has not really recovered since then. We've done some silly self-harming stuff like the way we've implemented the net zero project, very high energy costs and so on. Obviously, we all had the COVID issue to deal with. Brexit's just one part of that. And actually, if you look at the economics, if you look at the figures, if you look at our productivity record, you can't see Brexit at all. A lot of people believe there's been some sort of economic shock in Britain because of Brexit. You can't even see it in the figures. And in a way, that's why we're still arguing about mm-hmm. whether there has been an effect, precisely because you can't see it. So although a lot of people in the government at the moment are trying to scare us and say, you know, it's all been a disaster, we really need to get back closer, it's not borne out by the economics. It's entirely ideological. And meanwhile, the country has got used to Brexit almost without realizing it, I would say. The British Parliament is able to debate anything again and take decisions about it and make things happen. And that is happening. We are debating immigration, big problem, but it is at least under our control. We debate trade policy again. We didn't used to be able to control that, and so on and so forth. And gradually the democracy is coming back to life. People don't, I think, always register it, but you know, almost without realizing it, we've become a normal self-governing country again, and so much the better.
Yes. I have. Do you want to move on?
Just a short question. If there were another referendum now, what is the public opinion now in Britain? Would people again vote for Brexit, or do you think that the mood has changed?
I think if you look at the polling about on that question, it's more negative. There appears to be a majority in favour of the EU. Of course, it's an entirely theoretical question at the moment, and I think that what's coming through that is people's general unhappiness for the reasons I described, and they see Brexit as part of the many things that have made life more difficult for them in Britain over the last 10 or 15 years. I think a vote now obviously would be entirely different, because it would be a vote to rejoin rather than a vote to kind of tear ourselves out. And I just don't think, once people actually focus on the question, do you really want to join this project again? Do you want to go through this again? Do you want to have all the debates about self-government? Remember how it used to be, Britons, when we remember constantly arguing against everything, constantly trying to stop it, constantly complaining about lack of control. I don't think we'd have any problem in winning a second referendum in these circumstances.
I have a third question, and I think that's enough then on Brexit, which is about, I think, education, broadly conceived skills. I remember a conversation I had in my senior common room at my college with the domestic bursar, and he realised that I was probably a bit more sceptical of the European Union than he was. He was also sceptical. And so he said to me, "Yes, Oliver, Switzerland can stay outside because you have such an educated population, you are more skilled, whereas we here in Britain, we need to be in." And I took that as the kind of view that I've encountered many times, you know, on the part of the British establishment, that, well, our population is actually not sort of almost, you could say, to put it a bit in populist terms, an abandonment of a section of the population, the non-university educated, perhaps. What can Britain do to tackle that problem? Because I think it's one of the big issues, isn't it, that Boris Johnson also raised at the time with the levelling up agenda and all that. So I wonder what your views are on that.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously one of the drivers of the Brexit vote, and it's been one of the drivers of political turbulence since then. That and I don't think we're unusual in this either, that there's a large section of the population that feels it's done particularly badly over the last 20 or 25 years, and I think they're right. I don't know whether it's so much about sort of skills and training and so on. I think it's in Britain it's very much a regional problem, that London and the South East is really the bit of the country that's got globalised. It benefited from being close to the EU while we remember. It obviously has the city and the kind of global perspective. And the rest of the country, you know, is relatively poorer. So I think if there was, you know, and there definitely is, actually, that sort of feeling, it's more geographical, that, you know, bits of the country have been left behind, have not recovered from the crash, are not recovering, and are slipping further behind. And I think it's certainly true when you travel around the country that you know, quite a bit of Britain, unfortunately, looks rather tired, run down, and not as well off as we used to. You know, Brexit and the control it gives us really ought to be the way we fix that problem. The trouble is, the debate has been a bit about, it's been too much about how do we spend more? How do we spend more government money in relatively depressed areas in northern England, which to me is the wrong way of putting it. So to me, the way should be, how do we free things up? How do we deregulate? How do we reduce taxes? How do we make it more profitable to operate and more worthwhile in poor areas of the country so people want to come and invest and grow? That, that is the way to do it. It's impossible in the EU for state aid and all sorts of other reasons, but we can do that now if we want. If we want.
I would like to touch a little bit on Switzerland, of course, and our relationship to the European Union. As you know, we have been debating this question now also, like the Brits, for 30 years, I would say, and it started also in the early 90s. And the man who was responsible actually for one of the most important victories, to my mind, in our democracy, the referendum about EEA, sits in the audience, Christoph Blocher, Alt-Bundesrat, old federal councillor, we are saying that in Switzerland. And I wanted to ask you, as you know, we have been negotiating now new treaties with the European Union. Of course, they say it's a success story, everything is all right. I know you know a little bit about those treaties. If you were Swiss, would you think those treaties are good, or would you say, no, please leave us alone?
Well, I wouldn't dream of telling Swiss how to vote when the referendum eventually comes round. Swiss,
but you're not German, you know. That's not the problem. If you were German, that would be a problem.
Switzerland's a very old democracy, and you don't need my view on that. But what I would say is that the treaties that have been negotiated seem qualitatively different to those in the past. They're very much like what the Labour government is trying to do in Britain in terms of, as they would say, updating the agreement we did in 2020, because they both begin the process of subordinating decisions in this country or in the UK to European Union institutions again. And, you know, we know, we can see that in your agreement and in the one that Keir Starmer is trying to negotiate, the European Court of Justice, you know, gets the final say. And not over everything, but over a good chunk of things. And what you will find, I think, is that one thing leads to another. You know, you sign up for one set of rules where the EU has control, you'll find people saying, well, we're in this area, why shouldn't we be in this area as well? Isn't it logical? So the area becomes more and more and more expanded. The European courts and the institutions get more and more involved. You create a set of like lobbies here in Switzerland, lawyers, business that benefit from the situation and don't want to see it changed, always cause trouble, don't want confrontation with the EU. And you get sort of stuck. And I think that is the risk. It's very difficult, as we discovered, to take powers back from the EU once you've given them away. You have to be really careful what you're doing. And, you know, this treaty, like, as I say, like the one we're negotiating, sadly, back in Britain, you know, begins this process of subordination. So I think my advice would just be, you know, think really hard and be really careful what you get into, because it's much easier to get in than get out again.
What do you think? I mean, Switzerland is a small country. Of course, economically, we are more important, but still we are, for the European Union, we are really a small, small country. And still, they don't let it go. I mean, they really want to have this agreement. They really want to change our laws and so on. What's the reason for that? Why is small Switzerland such a nuisance for the EU?
I mean, I used to antagonise Michel Barnier with a version of this question, because, of course, he thinks of Britain as a small country as well, which we are. You know, I used to wind him up by saying, you know, can it really live with genuinely independent countries doing things in a different way on the continent of Europe. You know, I don't think the European really is union really is willing to live with that, and that's the real underlying problem. They don't like countries doing things differently and succeeding, because then it raises the question of, well, why do we have to do everything a different way in the European Union, and why do we not get any say in it? It's a threat to their own model. Their own model is based on homogenization, on uniformity, on regulation of this big area, whereas Europe has always succeeded in the past when it's had lots of kind of competing territories doing things differently. So Swiss independence doing things differently is a problem, and so was ours for them. We haven't done everything we should have done, I think, mm-hmm. to benefit from it yet, but it was very clear to me when I was doing the negotiations, they were extremely nervous that Britain would embark on a kind of deregulating neoliberal programme that would make life very difficult for them. And there's quite a lot in the trade agreement that tries to stop this happening. So, you know, however small you are, they don't like to let you kind of completely off the hook and do things differently.
So in a way, it's similar to Russia not liking the competition of Ukraine, in a way, because I mean, it's a tough comparison. It's, but I think it's also
the
competition.
Different.
Yeah, of course. But the competition is the problem.
The competition is the problem, and you know, as I say, their model relies on uniformity.
Right.
Europe succeeds when it allows competition and
right.
variation.
As you know, also in Switzerland, we know the Project Fear, that people are just warning us all the time, if we don't have good relationships to our neighbors, that's a problem economically and so on. If we are going to say no, and I hope so, then what do you think would the EU do? Would they really harm us, or what would be the consequences?
Well, I mean, they always make lots of threats in these circumstances, and they've threatened Switzerland in the past, and you know, they've done more than that with the financial services equivalence problem, the Swiss stock exchange, and so on in the past. And you'll find your establishment, I've no doubt, magnifying all those threats and saying we can't afford to, you know, turn this down, or the sky will fall in, the Swiss economy will collapse, all this kind of thing, because that's what always happens. I don't believe that. I think the EU is very ideological in the long run and very pragmatic in the short run. And, you know, if Switzerland votes against these agreements, life will carry on. Maybe they'll make life a bit more difficult for you at the borders. They'll impose more paperwork and so on. But, you know, life goes on. Modern market economies are extremely adaptive, capable entities, and you know, honestly, I think there's nothing to fear if you want to keep your national independence. That would be my view. Don't give in to Project Fear. Try and look at it objectively.
Oliver, shall we move on to more geopolitical
issues?
Yeah.
Shall I start?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on the geopolitical front, I mean, one of the things that you often hear is you need blocks now. We live in a world where it's no good having nation states. They need to be members of blocks. So what do you think about that? Do we need to team up? Also have institutional agreements in this world nowadays, because we are no longer living in a rules-based society, as is often claimed.
I mean, I think it's always been true to some extent and for some purposes that being in a bloc was helpful. I mean, obviously Switzerland is kind of even more independent the UK, in that, you know, you've not been in NATO, you've not been in defence pacts. And I think being in a defence pact, you know, is a sensible thing to do, and NATO has been quite a good one. That's for defence. It doesn't mean you can generalise that to every other activity of, you know, human activity. Being in a trade bloc, it depends, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It depends what the trade-off is and what you think is important. I think that a country like Britain, a very international country, benefits from being able to set its own tariffs and having a floating currency and being able to adjust to events rather than having these controlled from elsewhere. But these are trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different people can come to different views. So I think the world is, you know, a bit scarier than it used to be, and having allies and friends who will defend you is a good thing.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, you know, we're in a world where only great powers matter. I don't think that.
But it's an important argument, of course, in Switzerland also for voting yes to this agreement, because people say, oh, it's now so dangerous in this world and we really have to be aligned with the European Union. But actually, if you look at the whole world, such a bloc like the European Union is actually an exception.
Yes.
Nobody outside of Europe thinks it's a very good idea to have this kind of bloc.
No, absolutely not. No, in most of the world, people still think the nation state is a viable thing and expect to do things through their nation state. They, you know, Europe is kind of tied up in this defeatism where we don't think we can do anything unless we're part of a bloc and a court and institutions and all these things that go with it. And I just don't see why this is the case. It's only Europe that thinks like that. So I absolutely agree with you. I think it's a kind of distortion of thinking in Europe that it isn't really correct and isn't really true in the rest of the world.
I mean, we are part actually of the same generation, and I think it has changed in our generation that people think the nation state is over and so on. What do you think is the reason for that, for this notion?
I mean, I only discovered after the Brexit referendum in 2016 that the German view of the nation state had spread quite so strongly to Britain. You know, that all of a sudden I learned that, you know, a substantial minority, let's say, it wasn't everybody who voted Remain, but a substantial chunk of it, you know, thought that the United Kingdom nation state didn't count for anything, was obsolete, outdated, they were loyal to either to Brussels or some sort of transnational kind of entity policy making thing. And I think that is at the root of it, to be honest, in Europe. I think, you know, the German view, I'm not blaming the Germans for this, but, you know, the German view after 1945, for perfectly good reasons, that it will be better to try and move beyond the nation state, has got very widely spread amongst European establishment, elite, intellectual classes. They don't necessarily feel loyal to their own nation state in the same way. It's a bit the point you were making, Oliver, earlier, that people don't necessarily see themselves as having the same interests as the people in their own country, but mm-hmm. with the people mm-hmm. like them elsewhere. And it's gone a lot further in Europe, mm-hmm. I think, than elsewhere. And I don't think it makes sense. I mean, my personal belief is that the nation state, as it, you know, it formed for most countries in the 19th century, for Switzerland, for England anyway, quite a lot earlier, that is the best way we found of organising human affairs, in organising the debates that come with politics, managing them within a agreed consensual framework that everybody accepts. Nobody's found anything better yet. So to throw that away, and in particular throw it away for a European Union that, you know, isn't even a federal state. You know, it's a mess where, you know, there's no real connection between your vote and your political party and what actually happens in the institutions that take decisions. To throw that away is extremely dangerous. It's when people feel disconnected, when they feel they can't affect things, that you get the kind of currents of thought that everybody is worrying about. And I worry that the EU is actually incubating these rather than repressing them.
Yes, I mean, I have a sort of a question that is perhaps a bit bold. I mean, I think this question of countries having missions, I sometimes think that Britain and Switzerland, both of them, I think sometimes that you always need to argue in this day and age also. You can't just say we are different and leave us alone. We want to do things differently. I sometimes think even that we should stress a bit more that countries like Britain and Switzerland, they stand for something which is very valuable, namely self-government. Mm. And how can we get people to again kind of rally behind that cry? Because in a way, it's interesting, such a precious thing. If you think about the 20th century, the world wars and so on, and Britain, you know, Britain stood fast, and Britain defended the free world and so on, and Britain had a parliament that continued, and we played a different role. But also, it is a self-government, and giving powers to the citizen is actually a very, very precious thing. And we have almost moved to a point where I think we are not confident enough to actually stress this enough. And actually, so this is what I mean by having a bit of a mission rather than just saying doing things differently.
Yeah, I mean, Britain in particular, I think until fairly recently, you know, Britain's particular contribution to sort of Western civilization was thought to be the art of governance. You know, if you read people at the end of the 19th century, first half of the 20th, they admire the British Constitution. They think that is the thing that we came up with and others didn't. The sort of supreme flexibility, the ability to kind of adapt without having to write things down over time, that was our kind of contribution. And, you know, others brought other contributions, but that was the British one. And, you know, it has lasted quite well, I think, around the world, at least as something to aspire to, and we've kind of sort of chucked it all away in the European Union for these 50 years in favour of a, you know, a very European norm written constitution, you know, very black and white rules about things, and no say or little say in the areas that matter. It's a great loss, I think. There's a lot of people now in Britain on the right who talk about a restoration, and what they mean is to try and go back, to try and restore some of this old constitution and the way the institutions worked. Now we can for the first time, and I think that'll be very good for us, because it's kind of part of the British DNA of how we work. So I hope we can do that in the next 20 years or so.
You are a Conservative, and just a question also about UK politics. You're a Conservative. The Conservatives are really under pressure. There is a right-wing competition now arising in Britain, and if you believe the latest polls, Farage, his Reform Party, is well ahead. So what is the future of the right in Britain? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, as you probably know, we have this electoral system that the first-past-the-post system, basically, that it punishes divided parties and favours parties that have, you know, are big blocks. We don't have the, you know, multi-party system in the same way that a lot of European countries do. And what this means is that, you know, if the right goes into the next election divided, then it's going to lose. That's why the Conservatives lost last time, or at least part of the reason. Therefore, what must happen if we'd succeed is either the Conservative Party must disappear, or Reform must disappear, or they must merge, or there must be some sort of pact or understanding. One of those things has got to happen, or we lose again. and nobody wants that to happen. Therefore, I'm fairly confident mm-hmm. one of those other things will happen. I just don't know which yet. and I think any of them are possibilities, to be honest. It's 3 years out, 3 years plus from an election yet. There's no pressure on reform and the Conservatives to cooperate yet. Mm-hmm. The incentive for both is to try and destroy the other and emerge as the winner. At the moment, reform is winning that competition. The Conservative Party is declining gradually. Whether it's reached the bottom or whether it has further to go, who knows yet. I think it makes it difficult for people on the right because, you know, it's hard to avoid taking positions on politics without appearing to support one or other of the arguments and the parties, and therefore reinforcing this division. And certainly what I try to do increasingly now is just talk about the ideas and just talk about the policies and support good policies, whether they come from Reform or the Conservatives, and criticise bad ones, whether they come from either, and just try and start winning the battle of ideas, mm-hmm. which is the crucial thing. You know, the ideological world of Britain and most of Europe is very left-wing now, and we have to start trying to win the argument mm-hmm. as well as win the electoral tactical battle, I mm-hmm. think, if we're going mm-hmm. to succeed.
Yeah, I have a question that relates specifically to probably how the legal system is being understood in our country, probably also in your country, and within the European Union. And you were you negotiated with the EU, with Barnier. So this is a question I really want to ask you, because subsidiarity, the concept subsidiarität in its classical sense, means, you know, you devolve at the lower level. You do not do things at the top when you can actually give the power to the local level, for example. And I realized that within the European Union, I mean, I wonder what you think about that. I think they have a different idea of subsidiarity, because they use the concept all the time. They talk about subsidiarity. Mm-hmm. But I also realized that with judges and university professors who are a part of this European legal sort of thinking, for them subsidiarity really means if a court at the lower level executes what is, in fact, the European law code. It took me quite a while to get around this, but what is your experience? I mean, when you must have had discussions about, for example, when you challenge them, you know, you want more subsidiarity, you want that kind of thing, that pressure thing. So I wonder what you can say about that.
I mean, I don't think the EU pays lip service to subsidiarity. It's in the treaty, but I don't know that it really believes in it in that sense. I think for most people in Brussels, subsidiarity means we take the decisions. There can be lower level institutions that kind of deliver them, but they don't really get any choice about how to go about it. And, you know, if you see the decline of directives as a way of legislating within the EU and the growth of regulations which give no choice about how you implement things, I think that's a symptom of it. And, you know, the EU is built on this very French Cartesian view of, you know, there's a pyramid with the European Court of Justice at the top, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to escape the logic of that. And I think they find it hard to imagine political systems that don't work like that, and where the powers come from elsewhere. I think it's difficult for them to get. It's sunk into the British constitution as well, because we've been having a debate over the last 6-7 years or so about whether we can overrule certain international treaties and so on, mainly to do with migration, but not only to do with that. And we also tried to overrule the withdrawal agreement from the EU in our own Parliament. And lots of people find it hard to understand that the British Parliament can do that. The British Parliament is sovereign in its own country. It doesn't matter what treaties it's signed. The British Parliament says what happens in Britain. If it overrules a treaty, of course, there's a political cost, but it absolutely has the legal power to do that if it wishes to do it. And a lot of people in Britain find this very hard to understand. In fact, I think increasingly they genuinely don't think that it is correct. Mm-hmm. The current Attorney General, the supreme legal advisor to the Labour government, will say it's not correct. You must obey international treaties if you sign them. That is not the British constitution. It's mm-hmm. done in a different way.
Yeah.
And it kind of symbolises this sense that, you know, power doesn't always flow from the top. Mm-hmm. It flows from domestic authority and consent.
Yeah.
And that's not prominent in the way the EU goes about its business, mm-hmm. I would say.
Maybe the last question. I mean, as you know, the mood in Europe is really gloomy. I mean, if you talk to the Germans or the French or even the Swiss, people are a little bit depressed and think we are in decline. China is much more important, India, America, and so on. What is your take on this? Do you think Europe has a good future? And are you optimistic about Europe? And what role is the European Union going to play in this future?
I mean, I think it's hard to be optimistic because, you know, Europe has so many problems and we've let things collectively slip quite a long way. You know, we have allowed our economic growth to slip behind the Americans, and we do seem to have lost quite a bit of the self-confidence that you'll find in China or Southeast Asia or wherever the parts of the world that really think they're going places. And, you know, we do seem to have slipped into this declinism a bit. And it's a great pity. There's no reason for it. It's just that summoning up the energy to get out of it seems extremely difficult. And I do think actually that if Europe is to recover from this somehow or other, it's got to give a bit more freedom to its nations to genuinely experiment and do things differently and try and recover some of this energy. If we insist on everything being done in Brussels at a European level, that's kind of recipe for nothing will ever happen, because everything becomes lowest common denominator. The politics is always very hard to get in line. And I know my worry, I've said this before, my worry is that Europe becomes a bit like the Habsburgs, the Austro-Hungarian Empire for the 21st century. You know, all the internal wiring is extremely complicated. They can never quite get things properly in order again. They're always a bit less the sum of the parts, just like Austria-Hungary was in the 19th and 20th century. And I think that is a risk. And, you know, I can't see Europe the European Union taking the step towards federalism and genuinely becoming a state. I think that's hard to imagine. Therefore, it needs to give more freedom and energy to its component parts if it's going to survive. Europe is, you know, it's a great civilization. Europe's the best civilization, I think, the values that we have brought to the world. And, you know, we really need to recapture some of that self-confidence and belief and get going again.
I think that's a very good comparison, the Austria-Hungarian Empire. I think the only thing which is missing, we have to have the capital of the European Union in Vienna again. I think it was an idea by the historian Ferguson, and I think it's a good idea, because in a way, and Vienna is still too big actually for Austria, so it would be nice for Vienna.
Yeah.
Okay, Lord Frost, thank you very much for this very interesting conversation, and thank you that you came to Switzerland, especially for this event. And I think people really enjoyed what you were saying about the European Union. As I told you, many, many people in Switzerland have no idea that in Britain, actually, yeah, the discussion is very similar to ours. Absolutely. And I think that was also a little bit, the idea behind this this event. So, and Oliver Zimmer, thank you very much for your collaboration. Actually, you were the guy who invited Lord Frost and had this contact with Lord Frost. So I think thank you both. And now we are ending this event and ich gehe zurück auf Schweizerdeutsch. Es war Bern einfach spezial mit dem Lord Frost und dem Oliver Zimmer und dem Marco Somm. Danke vielmals.
Das war Bern einfach.
Der Podcast wird gesponsert von Audizwiss, Ihrer Experte rund ums Thema Revision und Wirtschaftsprüfung. www.audizwiss.ch